This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. David Granite, and welcome to Health Matters. You have to say it almost in a whisper. Cancer. That's the way it seems to get said. And we're always looking for new and better and more innovative ways to treat cancer. Well, we have one of our experts here today with us, Dr. Lauren Mell. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Dr. Mell is an associate professor here at the University of California, San Diego, and I've got to read this because I want to make sure I get it right. You're chief of head and neck radiation oncology service and director of the clinical and translational research for the Department of Radiation Medicine.
Correct.
And let me just add this one thing. He's a hellaciously good researcher. I went through your what you've done and your background. We hadn't met before. I thought you were going to come in and you were going to be like 75 years old with gray hair because of what you've accomplished so far. It's very impressive, and I'm so glad that you found time to be with us today.
Well, thank you.
Along the way somewhere, I may have to ask you about your work at the National Bureau of Economic Research because it doesn't seem to fit exactly, but I bet you there's a way that you've put that together.
There's a story there.
Yeah, there'll be a story. But first, let's talk a little bit about cancer. And whenever we do this, I always like to start with people think they know, but what is cancer?
Well, cancer is basically a cell in your body that's lost its ability to regulate its own growth. And what particularly makes a cancer different than other benign tumors, which also have that characteristic, is that they can invade and metastasize. So they basically, through a variety of genetic mutations, they lose their ability to self-destruct and they grow uncontrollably.
And they transmit themselves around the body.
Exactly. Metastasis is probably the singular characteristic of a cancer.
Okay. And so I don't think there's a person that has not been in some way touched by cancer. And we have a host of different ways to treat cancer nowadays that are pretty darn good. Let's just touch base on what some of those are that are available now for most people. Back in the day, we had chemotherapy, and we still do. What is chemotherapy?
Well, chemotherapy is generally refers to a class of what we would call systemic therapies, and those have the ability to be distributed around the body and treat cancer cells potentially in any part of the body. Chemotherapies might be distinguished from some of the more modern systemic therapies that would be classified as targeted therapies in that they're relatively less specific. They generally, the mechanism is to damage DNA or inhibit synthesis of DNA versus targeting a specific mutation in the cell.
When I was in med school, I remember somehow sort of thinking that we're dumping a toxic chemical into the body and we're hoping that the cancer dies before the patient does.
Essentially,
what it felt like.
Essentially, that's true. I mean, it's controlled damage. Might help to back up a step and just say, so sort of the canonical treatments for cancer historically have been for surgery. So basically take out or extirpate the tumor. Second, along came radiation therapy in the late 19th century. If you might think of the cut, burn, poison almost model of it, right? So cut being surgery, burn being radiation, poison being chemotherapy, and that's in fact where it got its name. Now all of those, if done indiscriminately, can cause a lot of harm to people. But when done in a controlled way, they can be helpful, and you can limit the damage for therapeutic gain.
Well, let's touch base on a couple of those others because I want to make sure we've laid out what's current. The radiation approach, I think nowadays we have an Image Gently program so children don't get exposed to radiation. People are worried that radiation will cause cancer,
right?
But now you're using radiation in better and better ways to treat.
Right. That's absolutely correct. Radiation being cancers being caused by radiation are certainly a legitimate concern, and outside of a clinical or medical setting, that's a serious concern with reactor meltdowns and so forth. In a medical environment, though, and medical radiation is quite different and quite safe to use. But yes, the trend has been to use less and less radiation. We've been able to use better imaging technologies, better delivery technologies, and better physics, actually, in the form of, for example, proton therapy, which is appropriate for certain cases to really focus on the tumor and limit the amount of damage that's done.
Surgery still exists.
Definitely. It's a critical component of cancer care. Mm-hmm.
And so is there a type of cancer that typically is more amenable to be treated by surgery?
Definitely. There are certain cancers that are treated predominantly by surgery. For example, colorectal cancer, breast cancer is pretty much routinely approached surgically, at least in the early stages. And same could be said for lung cancer. Radiation therapy is appropriate for as the primary modality in certain types of cancer, cervix cancer or advanced head and neck cancers, certain prostate cancers, et cetera. And then chemotherapy is typically used as an adjunctive treatment or an adjuvant treatment, but is also obviously bears the main role in treating systemic hematologic malignancies like leukemias and lymphomas.
And then there's this word biologics. What's the role of biologics and what are they?
Well, it's a critical and exciting area, new dimension of research. It's been a component of cancer research for decades, but I think there's an understanding that surgery and radiation and chemotherapy work in relatively non-specific ways. They don't really have regard for the underlying biology of the tumor. They basically just either remove it or cause non-specific damage to it. And fortunately, that's quite effective. But unfortunately, it can cause a lot of side effects and is frequently ineffective for certain types of cancers. And so what we know now is we know relatively little about the biology in the grand scheme of things. But with better knowledge of specific mutations and specific genetic characteristics or patterns, we could exploit that for therapeutic gain and understand, specifically for an individual with this type of tumor and this type of genetic pattern, we might opt for this, specific therapy or need to develop new ones.
Well, so that's a pretty good background on where we sort of stand our treatment today. And now you're working on something completely different. I feel like a Monty Python skit. But this now there's this whole other new thing that you're working on that brings us to your research. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, we have we do a lot of research in many areas. One area that we're excited about is an area called oncolytic viral therapy. So that actually has been around for surprisingly for a long time, since even the early 20th century when it was observe that viruses, in addition to causing cancers, can actually, not that surprisingly, be kill cancer cells because of the way viruses work. They invade a cell, they replicate their own machinery, and then they ultimately explode the cell, or lyse it, if you will, and then go on to infect other cells in the environment. A critical property of viruses as well is that they for some reason, they particularly like to grow within tumors. And part of that probably is that they like to grow in cells that like to grow. And that we can exploit almost as a Trojan horse. There are other aspects, though, that bring it more into the modern era, and probably one of the hottest areas of cancer research right now is an area called immunotherapy. So we know and have known for a long time that immune dysfunction or dysregulation is critical in the formation and allowing cancers to propagate. We know that, for example, when people have infections like HIV or other less known ones like HTLV-1, they're predisposed to form cancers. what has been recently a very exciting avenue of research is knowing that if we can actually promote the immune system in a controlled way, we can actually treat cancers better. And there was quite a well-known New England Journal study that just came out in the treatment of melanoma. With viruses, of course, if we can get them to the tumor, we can cause an immune response, hopefully, and that can be also part of the therapeutic advantage to using viruses. And I guess I would finally say there's a third element to viral therapy, which is gene therapy. So by knowing the genome of a virus, you can actually modify it genetically and introduce genes that have a particular function into the cell. So if you wanted to, say, block a certain pathway, you could actually introduce that. So that's exciting.
That last aspect in ophthalmology where I live, we've been able to deliver genes into the eye quite successfully. And that's been, for my world, that's been an unbelievably huge advance. I was listening to you talking about the viruses and melanoma. Years ago, we had Malcolm Mitchell on the show, and Mal was castigated when he started using immunotherapy and other things within oncology. Some of the new stuff that you're doing, until finally showed it worked, but in some of the things that you're doing with viruses, is that, is everybody looking askance at it, or are you finding that so long as you stay with good, hard science, that those clinical trials and the work that you're doing is being well-received?
I think it's more the latter. I think anybody can respect good data, and we're all, you know, we're always looking for new strategies, because many things that we will try won't work. You know, as a matter of, you know, what's the hot area or what's popular, that does weigh in, because sometimes you have to make choices about which directions, for example, the NIH has to make that choice routinely in terms of what areas they're going to fund or fund.
There's a
heavily
limited pot of money. They have to decide where it's going to go.
Right. You know, good data tends to be well received, and you just have to, you know, do scientifically sound studies. And
so your research right now, mm-hmm. Where is it standing?
Okay. So there are a number of clinical trials that have been ongoing in oncolytic viral therapy for a while. What's novel about what we use, so we use a vector or a virus called vaccinia, which should be known to people as the smallpox vaccine. And in fact, that's how our vaccines, you know, originally sort of got their name from
vaccine.
The cowpox virus,
yeah.
You know, because for the Latin root vacca, right? So what's desirable about vaccinia relative to other viruses that we might use, like herpes or measles, is that it's not naturally a pathogen in humans. So the safety profile.
So it's a cow.
Yeah, it's exactly. So I always tell my patients, you have nothing to worry about unless you're a cow.
Cow.
Yeah, if you're a cow, then we have a different story.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that these treatments don't have their own side effects, but as a concern, of course, with gene therapies is that they could somehow mutate or alter their genetic composition in a way that might be harmful to people. And we put a high priority on safety, as we should. And so we have to walk very slowly. And part of that accounts for, you know, the slow pace of knowledge in cancer care, because there are regulations and constraints on what we can do and how fast we can do it.
Appropriately so,
I would say. So what we typically like to see is in cell cultures and in animal models that we can show that by giving the therapy relative to a control, that we can make tumors disappear faster, help you know, animals live longer, and that we can establish that it's safe to deliver. And if we can do
that. What types of cancer are you looking at?
So we've looked at, with this particular virus, our clinical trial is actually specific to head and neck carcinomas. So carcinomas arise from epithelial cancer. So most lung cancers, breast cancers, prostate, and head and neck cancers are carcinomas. So mostly we've looked at carcinomas, but we also have data in animal models in glioblastoma, which is a brain tumor, in lymphomas. So it's not this particular therapy is interesting because it's, in some ways it's specific, it's very specific, and in other ways it's actually nonspecific because it's not targeting a particular gene necessarily unless we, you know, use
so
the gene therapy aspect.
It may have a broad role to play.
Right, and that kind of gets into the three different strategic mechanisms for oncolytic viruses.
And how they work.
Right.
So your approach now is you've got these trials going on. Oh. If someone's out there and they wanted to participate in a trial, how would they know if they were appropriate?
Right. So we have to be very, especially for early studies, we have to be, again, fairly selective about how we test it and whom we test it for. So not everybody would be a candidate for the trial that we have open. We're not the only site to have a trial with this virus. There are ongoing studies at Royal Marsden Hospital in London, at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And of course, there are, you know, that's just of this particular virus. So broadly speaking, you know, many academic centers have many clinical trials. So,
and these trials, I mean, you mentioned, for example, glioblastoma. These trials are for tumors that we don't have great treatments for right now.
Right. Especially for when you're testing novel therapies, the concern always is, you know, is this safe? Can we, what dose should we deliver? And so there's risk involved. And whenever there's risk involved, what I want to see for a patient that I'm approaching is, your situation warrants this risk. You know, if you're 99% likely to be cured of your cancer, then that's not a situation where we want to test something that's risky. If you've tried a lot of therapies and your best outcome with known therapies is not good, then there's a rationale to try to better that. And so we do that in a stepwise way, and we try to start with in phases of clinical trials. So, you know, typically we'll do phase 1 to 2 to 3, and there are variations of clinical trial designs within that. But essentially a phase 1 trial is designed to determine what's the safe dose and regimen to give. And then after you've established that, then we try to assess in a phase 2 trial, okay, is there some evidence that it's effective? And a phase 3 trial is generally designed to answer the question, okay, if we were to apply this broadly in the population, what sorts of outcomes could we expect in terms of people's survival or their quality of life? So
when somebody participates in a clinical trial, they have the opportunity not only theoretically to help themselves, but to get information that could make a huge difference for other people.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way that if you think of an evidence-based approach to medicine, which we generally value in the academic community, that evidence has to come from somewhere. And so when people agree to participate in clinical trials, they're paying it forward, and in a way, they're also paying it back. I mean, the knowledge that we have gained insofar as we're able to treat them with therapies that we know can be beneficial, that was learned by, you know, our historical experience with clinical trials before.
So. And they're the recipient of that.
Right.
Some of this has genetic predispositions, so people in their own family may even be touched by it eventually.
Absolutely, yeah.
Money, you know, matters. And some of these trials are funded by the NIH, but that's a limited budget, and it's harder and harder than it used to be to even get that money.
Right.
Some of it's funded by industry.
Right.
Is that, you know, some people look askance, there's a company that wants to make money off of this. Mm-hmm. But does that relationship really work? Is that a very positive thing for most people?
I think it generally is a positive thing because these treatments have to come from somewhere. And often they're, you know, for these novel therapeutic approaches, there's a lot of investment that has to be made on the part of individuals and companies and investors that have to say, okay, I'm willing to take the risk, you know, and they're not going to do that if they can't see a return on the other side of it. And especially knowing that many of the even promising treatments that we will try will ultimately not work when you really put them to the test. That said, the NIH and other public funding agencies play an absolutely crucial role as a check on that, because if the system is completely dominated by research questions that the pharmaceutical companies define, that's a problem because there are many questions that go beyond the interest level of pharmaceutical companies, that where there may not be a monetary gain, but patients may gain significantly from the knowledge, and that's a crucial role that the NIH plays. As you know, government funding becomes less and less for those resources, you can guess which way the balance tips. But it's quite possible to do very top shelf objective science, clinical science, even within the constraints of a conflict of interest.
And clearly, private companies want to work with the best investigators. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to turn to a place like UC San Diego and say, you know, here's what we've got. We want to know if this works. We want to do the right thing. We wouldn't mind making money. But, you know, I don't think anybody doesn't want to do the right thing along the way.
Right. And that's been my experience working with companies as well. When you start with smaller trials, it's easier to do as a single center. You can get enough patients to answer a question by yourself. As you get into later phase trials, though,
they have to be bigger.
Yeah, they have to be bigger because you need the statistical power. And in order to get that power, you need to actually collaborate. So a lot of clinical trials is about developing the relationships and networks with other investigators that share your interest. And
is that where your work in the economic research world helped you?
Well, interestingly, it does. I use that every day. I have, of course, a lot of students and residents, and for trainees especially, it can be hard. You know, it takes a long time for clinical trial data to mature. So, what do you have them work on in the meantime? Well, part of the problem that you addressed with shrinking and ever more limited resources for clinical trials is, how do you get the same amount of information with less money? And that was basically an efficiency problem. So when I worked at the National Bureau of Economic Research, my emphasis was on understanding health events and the economic impacts of those. But it's a lot of statistics and statistical modeling. We use that now actually to try to design more efficient clinical trials so that we can get more information for less money, and that ultimately will help patients. In an ideal world, you'd have unlimited, amounts of money, and you can answer all these questions over and over again. But that's not the reality. So we have to be choosy. But what I always tell my students is, efficiency is never an irrelevant problem. Money will always be a constraint.
Always relevant. Yeah. So along those lines, just a word for those people who think there are better treatments outside the United States, or they heard about something that's going on in another country that they can't get here yet.
Right.
It may not have had the science behind it, or maybe it did, but quicker than you get it in the United States. How do you, if you're someone sitting at home, do I enroll in a clinical trial in the U.S.? Do I fly somewhere for medical tourism and get my treatment elsewhere?
Right.
What do I do?
That can be difficult and possibly specific to the situation that someone finds himself in. When a typical patient, in the U.S., when they're told by their doctors, we have nothing left to offer you, it's not surprising that they would look outside the borders and try to find other, avenues to treat their cancer. What unfortunately happens, I think, is a lot of centers set themselves up knowing that there's a market out there.
And the desperate patient.
Of desperate patients, and that they're easy to take advantage of because they don't care so much about what, the evidence is. It's always a fine line, really, between strength of evidence, because just because something evidence doesn't exist doesn't necessarily mean
it doesn't work. Right.
But I think that probably the only piece of advice I can say is find an oncology team or an oncologist that you trust and you think is smart and has your best interests in mind, and seek their opinion. If someone's going across into another country for coffee enemas or Laetril or what have you, things that are proven to not to be bunk, that are wasting their time. But if there's a novel, you know, clinical trial. That's why, again, I guess I would come back to clinical trials, because they demand a certain level of rigor. So if someone's going on an approved phase one clinical trial where, you know, ethics committees have reviewed it, scientific committees have reviewed it, you know that you're getting something that's vetted as safe and scientifically sound. And within that, then I see no problem in...
And if they come to a place like UC San Diego, where you're at, even if it's something that you don't do, you're generally aware of all the trials that are going on, or you can very quickly get your hands on that information to help see if they're eligible for a trial elsewhere.
That's right. The NIH, cancer.gov, has a whole host of clinical trials that are actually phone numbers at the National Cancer Institute that people can call and identify trials that they might be available for. Because for many patients, it's not going to be feasible. Even patients in the San Diego area, it can be difficult for them to travel, you know, long distances. But at least being aware of where trials are, I often get inquiries about our oncolytic virus trial, our vaccinia trial, from patients who don't meet the, you know, eligibility criteria. But I try to steer them towards my colleagues who might be able to help them. And their vaccine is not the only promising therapeutic strategy out there.
Sure. But you need an expert who can look at all the different tools they have. You know, they say a good carpenter has a lot of tools in their toolbox.
Right.
You can pick out which one is the right one at the right time.
Right.
In the minute or so we have left, I'm going to give the world to you, and you control it now. The world according to Mal, what would you like to see going forward in your field or in the way medicine is working in the future, how you'd like to have it go forward over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, it's a lot of responsibility that you just laid out. But I think probably, in my view, coming from where I sit, I think that the most critical direction that we need to do is expand our clinical trials network. We have a long backlog, actually, of promising therapies that people have worked diligently over decades to identify great strategies. You know, there's a lot of potential out there, but what gives meaning to that work is showing that it helps people. And we are at a critical point where we really are struggling to get the high quality large trials to confirm or deny that something is beneficial. And so I think there are a lot of patients worldwide with cancer. We can do better in terms of our partnering and networking to learn how to treat these patients better.
The power of big data. And it's while you were talking, I was thinking, it's not the money. It's the money.
Right.
If you had the money, it would support your activities. Well, thank you so much for all the work that you do every day, and thank you for spending a few minutes with us chatting about all of it to educate our population.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, this has been another one of those great shows where you hopefully have listened carefully and learned. Dr. Mel is doing incredible work, but I wanted you to hear about the value of clinical trials. His work in cancer is special and incredibly meaningful and important. But the value of clinical trials is what makes it so valuable. The idea that we're studying something to understand it, so we have knowledge, because, as you hear me say every time, knowledge is power. I'm Dr. David Granite, and we'll see you again next time right here on Health Matters.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.